Thank you, Lenore. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it's an honor for me to address this evening's gathering, especially given this meeting's subject matter. The phrases social justice and Philadelphia Society are not, I suspect, terms many people use in the same sentence. Indeed, for people of my age and philosophical disposition, the term social justice tends to be synonymous with expressions like emotional baby boomer or nuns on buses. All three of the dear ladies. But whether we like it or not, the various causes that have adopted social justice as their mantra seem to be ascendant today. Appeals to social justice have become part of the rhetorical apparatus of virtually all centre-left movements and modern liberal discourse, especially as expressed through the John Rawls's writings. In Western Europe, the term has been embraced by more than a few centre-right parties. And in many religious communities, you can apparently believe whatever you want about Christ's divinity, but questioning any program that carries the label social justice is a guaranteed fast track to ecclesiastical oblivion. Now, a common criticism of the concept of social justice is that it appears to have no concrete meaning. Now, this rather serious complaint features prominently in Friedrich Hayek's Law, Legislation, and Liberty. And I don't think there's much doubt that the phrase social justice often functions as a surrogate for other agendas that might otherwise have difficulty gaining traction. Why, for example, use words like socialism or social democracy when you can appeal to social justice? Plenty of Americans will readily say they're against socialism, but who will say they are for social injustice? Now, this, I think, underscores social justice's proven rhetorical power. For in the name of social justice, numerous programs have been enacted for the redistribution and redistribution of wealth via the state. In the name of social justice, government program after government program has supplanted the intermediate associations Tocqueville considered unique to America. In the name of social justice, parts of our universities have been turned into factories for indoctrination. And in the name of realizing social justice via Obamacare, we're currently witnessing one of the most serious attacks on America's commitment to religious liberty since the Republic's founding. Now, having said all that, I think there is at least one defensible conception of social justice. It emerges from the natural law tradition, the tradition of reasoning from first principles of practical reason that begins with Socrates and is associated with names such as Aquinas, Francisco Suarez, Robert Bellarmine, Hugo Grotius, and Richard Hooker. It's very, very difficult to overstate the influence of this tradition, including upon the founders of the United States. Whether it's political, legal, or economic thought, natural law reasoning and language is hardwired into the West's DNA, including its treatment of justice. Now, natural law has identified justice as one of the cardinal virtues ever since Aristotle began his treatment of justice with the notion of general justice. Now, by this, Aristotle meant comprehensive virtue concerning our relationships with other people. Justice as a virtue was understood in this tradition as having a uniquely social dimension. Another element of general justice which appears very early in the tradition is that of duty, in the sense of what we owe others. This was closely associated with a third feature, equality. Now, this was not understood as everyone being entitled to exactly the same, regardless of need or merit. Instead, it meant the particular understanding of justice that's expressed in the Golden Rule. In other words, it's about willing the flourishing of our neighbour. Now, Aristotle and Aquinas were quite clear that it's from general justice that the other modes of justice, such as commutative justice or distributive justice, flow. Neo-scholastic thinkers, such as Cardinal Cajetan, however, tended to place all these forms of justice on the same level. Now, I suspect everyone here, except Professor Liggio, is probably wondering why this brief foray into the arcana of scholasticism matters for us in 2013. Well, it matters because the very term social justice first emerged in natural law thinking in the 1830s as an attempt to do three things. First, to restore general justice to the primary position where Aquinas placed it. Second, to deepen the link between justice and human flourishing. And third, to revive the significance of justice as a virtue. And as I recently suggested in a paper published by Liberty Fund's Library of Law and Liberty, this conception of social justice takes freedom seriously and significantly limits state power. But this understanding of social justice is rather different from the Rousseauian and Rawlsian conceptions that dominate today. In these traditions, social justice is not understood in terms of the Golden Rule. They say nothing about justice as a virtue. In fact, they generally repudiate any concern for thick conceptions of human flourishing. Instead, they focus almost exclusively on equality. Not equality in the sense of everyone possessing equal dignity. No, once we strip away the tortured argumentation of a John Rawls, we soon discover modern social justice is essentially about sameness. Because for all the talk about diversity, modern social justice implies the elimination of difference. Differences of outcome, differences of political view, even in some cases, the differences that flow from our different genetic endowments. Modern social justice is not about human flourishing. It's not about the common good. It's about leveling. It's about realizing a sameness of starting point and a sameness of end point. And that translates into a warrant for virtually endless state intervention as governments start to establish starting points and endpoints that simply can't be realized in any society that takes freedom and human flourishing seriously. So, where do we go from here? I think there are two distinct, albeit complementary, paths. The first involves relentlessly critiquing modern conceptions of social justice, and at least in the case of those of us who believe in natural law, presenting the natural law alternative. There is, however, also a second path to loosening modern social justice's grip over so many people's imagination. And this involves recognizing that, in many respects, the social justice train has left the station. Rawlsian and Rousseauian interpretations of social justice are regnant. Moreover, they've proved extremely effective in coalescing support for modern liberal and social democratic priorities. The fact that the policies associated with modern social justice are profoundly damaging to life and liberty and rely on extremely shallow understandings of happiness is in some ways irrelevant. How do we know this? Well, ironically enough, I think we know this by considering what we, the non-left, are generally good at and what we presently seem to be not so good at. We are, as many modern liberals freely concede, very good at developing policies that positively transform people's lives. Thanks to many of the people and organizations represented here tonight, we are very, very good, even exceptional, at policy. But it's difficult to dispute that, at least today, some conservatives, classical liberals, and free marketers struggle to articulate these policies within an overall vision of the good that goes beyond effectiveness and efficiency. Now, we can and do rage against the gap between the lofty rhetoric of modern social justice and the disastrous policies associated with it. But venting doesn't help solve the problem. Moreover, it's not even a new problem. In his book, The Great Persuasion, for example, the historian Angus Bergen argues that from the late 1950s onwards, efforts within Western free market circles to make thick moral arguments in favour of free markets and liberty more generally were gradually supplanted by, quote, a relentless emphasis on the superior efficiency of laissez-faire and an abandonment of the language of values, end quote. And there's a very practical problem with imagining that normative questions are somehow hopelessly subjective and therefore unresolvable. The problem is that while many people might accept, for example, that markets are more efficient than Keynesian arrangements, the same people remain unconvinced of the moral case for economic liberty. Now, if that's true, it should radically reshape the ways in which we seek to stem America's present drift towards economic Europeanization and political Detroitification. Changing policies is important. But if we want to roll back the modern social justice agenda, all of us need to engage the normative dimension more comprehensively, more seriously, and in a sustained manner. Now, of course, there have been attempts on our part to develop broad, grand narratives that realize this end. Fusionism was one such effort. In more recent times, we've witnessed the rise and fall of compassionate conservatism. Of late, there's been discussion of constitutional conservatism, as well as what's called market democracy. Now, I don't want to be too critical of these attempts to develop substantive normative arguments, because at least they've tried to address a real challenge. And to my mind, being proactive in this area is far preferable to being a carping skeptic who sits on the sidelines tearing other people down. Now, that said, I think some of these efforts suffered from significant problems, ranging from internal incoherence to insufficient wariness of government. Some more recent suggestions, however, seem to reflect an apparent willingness to adapt to, rather than change, the present status quo. A status quo which, we're told, is one in which Americans are more at ease with big government on the one hand and soft relativism on the other. But a major difficulty with these adaptation proposals is that they don't seem to flow from a coherent set of principles which have been carefully developed, critically analyzed, and then rigorously defended. Instead, they often seem largely derived from people reading opinion polls and then formulating their positions. I believe the current euphemism used by some politicians to describe this is to evolve one's position. Now, of course, it would be very imprudent to ignore what's happening in America. If, for example, many Americans seem content to settle for soft despotism under the rubric of social justice, then we need to know why. That, however, is not a reason to merely reconcile ourselves to this status quo. Even less is it a reason to turn over the content of our message to consultants and pollsters. Their job is to sell the message, not to determine what the content is. Now, this evening I don't propose to outline a detailed alternative capable of replicating the left's immense success in using social justice language to win hearts and corrupt minds. I do, however, want to make one suggestion, which is this: that one way for us to begin retaking the moral high ground is to return, intellectually speaking, to the place from which this society takes its name. One reason I continue to find the people who gathered together in Philadelphia in 1776 to be so relevant is the seriousness with which they thought about freedom's prerequisites and freedom's ends. But I also believe that the sheer richness of the lives led by so many of these individuals point us in the direction of a message. One, I think, that's more than capable of not just competing with modern social justice rhetoric, but also highlighting the mediocrity promoted by modern social justice reality. Let me just take one of the lesser-known founders to illustrate my point. Charles Carroll of Carrollton is most often remembered as the last signer of the Declaration of Independence to depart this world. Rather fewer, however, know he was also the richest signer of them all. Charles Carroll inherited considerable wealth, but as a successful businessman in his own right, he multiplied his holdings several times over. On his journeys throughout America, Carroll was forever identifying new commercial opportunities. In other words, Carroll was that quintessential American phenomenon, an entrepreneur. And yet, none of these business activities prevented Carroll from pursuing the life of the mind and acquiring genuine erudition. Nor did they inhibit him from long-term involvement in public affairs, whether as a legislator or as a learned discussion of America's constitutional framework, or as a strong advocate of free trade and hard money, or as an unyielding fighter for religious liberty. In other words, despite the Republic's commercial character, men like Carroll managed to combine, almost seamlessly, the pursuit of economic success with the realization of other goods, fine conversation, the acquisition of knowledge, philanthropy, cultivation of the arts, and prayer, and contemplation of the ultimate realities. Many of them were simultaneously philosophers, merchants, fathers, soldiers, scientists, educators, revolutionaries, and even, in some cases, genuine statesmen. And here is why this matters for us today. Does not the life of a Charles Carroll, or a George Washington, or a John Adams, or a James Madison, or an Alexander Hamilton, do they not provide us with inspiring examples of what life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is supposed to be about? And do not their lives underscore the sheer banality of the egalitarian leveling promoted by modern social justice? Were America's founders in full agreement about all matters, philosophical and practical? Most certainly not. They argued about virtually everything, ranging from foreign affairs to the finer details of monetary policy. And looking at all of us here tonight, I'd suggest in that respect, little seems to have changed. Yet, despite these differences, it's remarkable just how much America's founders shared a common moral understanding of what they thought America should be about. All of them used the language of liberty, but few of them were philosophical hedonists. Theirs was not a vision of freedom detached from right reason and free will. Theirs was a belief in an America in which government was limited, the economy was free, and society was characterized by a rich associational life. But more fundamentally, theirs was an idea of the New World, not as a social justice utopia, but rather as a civilization of free and virtuous citizens. And that was more than enough to unite people with as different religious views as a Thomas Jefferson, a John Witherspoon, or a Charles Carroll. This truth about human beings, that we are indeed made free, was central to the American Revolution, as were several other truths that flowed from this basic point, that people, for instance, should be free rather than serfs, that there are limits to government power over people's lives and property, and that, consistent with public order, people ought to be free to live out their liberty, the end of which, at least for the founders, was virtue, truth, and human flourishing. Not vice, not error, and certainly not mediocrity. Now, my suggestion to you tonight is that these principles are more than capable of breaking the spell that's been cast by modern social justice rhetoric over so many Americans today. After all, it's been enough of a moral and practical ideal to encourage millions to risk uprooting themselves, to leave their homelands and families forever, and to migrate to the New World in the hope that they could live out the freedoms with which everyone has been endowed. And millions of these people made it, as Americans like to say. And they made it without any of the artifacts of modern social justice, such as welfare checks, affirmative action programs, or even a course in gender studies. Now, surely, ladies and gentlemen, these are some of the rich normative messages we can deploy to combat the current sway of modern social justice. It's a way of making the point that the soft despotism fostered by modern social justice isn't just economically unsustainable, it's also deeply dehumanizing and profoundly unfaithful to the hopes of those who created the Republic. Indeed, those who were present at the creation themselves knew that Americans could all too easily lose a sense of the greatness of the revolutionary achievement. On the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, Charles Carroll felt compelled to, quote, "recommend to the present and future generation the principles of the Declaration as the best earthly inheritance their ancestors could bequeath to them," end quote. The best earthly inheritance. That's very strong language. And the importance of securing these liberties, in Carroll's view, went far beyond America. Because Carroll went on to ask his fellow citizens to, quote, "pray that the civil and religious liberties that the revolutionary generation had secured for America," quote, "may be extended to the whole family of mankind," end quote. In short, ladies and gentlemen, the stakes are high. Why? Because these words remind us that the success of the American experiment isn't just about America. The soft despotism fostered by modern social justice is positively corrupting of civilization. We only have to look at Western Europe, or at the state of California, or at Illinois, to see evidence of that corrosion. Proof that includes, but also goes far beyond, the economic paralysis crippling these parts of the world. So now, more than ever, now is the time for us, for those of us who believe that what happened in Philadelphia still matters, to test the proposition that America itself is a propositional nation, to test whether America still has the capacity to become itself again by returning to the moral roots of its founding. And yes, this is about the long term rather than our immediate challenges, let alone the next election. And of course, in our age of short attention spans and activism for the sake of activism, that means defying contemporary expectations. Yet if there's anything to be learned from the left's unyielding promotion of modern social justice over the past 80 years, it's that sustained commitment to a normative vision, however deeply flawed, tends to win out. We can and we must continue to argue and win the policy battles. Unless, however, more of us make the same long-term investment that the left has made in persuading people of the rightness and the justice of our cause, I genuinely fear for the Republic. George Washington once said, quote, "Truth will ultimately prevail where there is pains to bring it to light," end quote. Let us not be the ones to shirk those pains. Instead, let us embrace them. Let us dare to think in centuries so that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness does prevail. Thank you.